Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for May 17, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. The main article on the front page today is entitled Local Lawmakers Rate 2023 Legislative Session. The Globe Gazette surveyed North Iowa legislators to get their views on the highs and lows of the 2023 legislative session that ended May 4. Below are their responses. Jane Bloomingdale. She is a Republican who resides in Northwood and represents House District 60. She is an accountant and in her fourth term in the Iowa House. Bloomingdale is the chair of the House State Government Committee. Key votes, education savings accounts, no. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, yes. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics, school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bills sponsored, House File 75 allows county supervisors to eliminate compensation boards and sets requirements for county compensation boards, did not pass. House File 55 allows all county treasurers to do a list of motor vehicle registration actions, did not pass. And House File 575 expands who can receive free and reduced school lunch, did not pass. Successes of the session. This session, I had the opportunity to manage the government reorganization bill through the Iowa House. It was a great learning experience for me as I met with and learned about each department and realized just how bloated our state government had gotten. With that bill, we reduced the number of state agencies from 37 to 16. No state employees will lose their job, and no state services will be lost. We eliminated redundancies and increased efficiencies to streamline state government and save the taxpayers money. I had a great subcommittee and committee, and I'm very proud of the work we did on this long overdue bill. Disappointments from the session? The Length of Service Award Program bill passed unanimously in the House, but failed to get to the Senate floor for the second time. This bill creates a grant program allowing municipalities to provide a tax-deferred award to our volunteer firefighters, emergency medical care providers, and reserve police officers. The grant would provide up to a dollar for dollar in matching funds for communities that establish this award. Several people have worked on this bill over the last few years, and hopefully we can move it through the Senate next year. Waylon Brown is a Republican who resides in Osage and represents Senate District 30. He is a farmer and construction company owner and in his second term in the Iowa Senate. Brown is the Senate Majority Whip and chair of the Senate Commerce Committee. Key votes, education savings accounts, yes. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, yes. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics, school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bills sponsored. Senate File 301 creates new licensing options for native breweries, did not pass. Senate File 89 states that confidential mail sent from an attorney to a prison inmate shall not contain correspondence from anyone other than the attorney, did not pass. Senate File 87 requires that public school student athletes undergo a cardiac evaluation to participate in school activities, did not pass. Shannon Latham is a Republican who resides in Sheffield and represents House District 55. She is a business owner and in her second term in the Iowa House. Latham is the chair of the House Local Government Committee. Key votes. Education savings accounts, yes. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, no. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics, school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bills sponsored. House File 119 makes assault of a pregnant person a Class C felony, signed into law with amendments as House File 570. House File 481 establishes a scholarship program for U.S. Army Reserve members, did not pass. House File 389 establishes an agriculture education grant program within the Department of Education, did not pass. Sharon Sue Steckman is a Democrat who resides in Mason City and represents House District 59. She is a retired educator and in her eighth term in the Iowa House. Steckman is an assistant minority leader and ranking member of the House Education Committee. Her key votes, education savings accounts, no. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, no. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics, school library books, no. Loosening child labor laws, no. Bills sponsored. House File 437 requires school boards to appoint student liaisons, did not pass. House File 167 establishes a $1 million fund to support food banks, did not pass. House Joint Resolution 9 proposes amending the Constitution to protect abortion rights, did not pass. Successes of the session. Three bills that come to mind when I think of legislative successes for this session would be House File 718, Property Tax Relief for Seniors, Vets, and Middle-Class Iowans, a suicide hotline number to include on the back of student ID cards, a bill students had wanted for several years, and finally, I was on a bill that expanded mental health services via the Multi-State Counselor Compact. As Assistant Minority Leader, I sponsored several events to bring the new legislators in our caucus and the veteran members together to create a cohesive working environment. Disappointments from the session. In my opinion, this was a disastrous session for Iowans. In Senate File 494, health care and food was taken away from children. In Senate File 542, protections for working children were rolled back, and they now will be working longer hours in more dangerous jobs and will be allowed to serve and mix alcohol. Other bills banned books, limited parents' ability to make health care decisions for their children, marginalized the LGBTQ community, shifted money to vouchers for private schools while underfunding public education, and stripped power from the state auditor to do his job of uncovering waste and fraud. Henry Stone is a Republican who resides in Forest City and represents House District 9. He is in his second term in the Iowa House. Stone is the House Majority Whip. Key votes. Education savings accounts, yes. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, yes. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics and school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bills sponsored. Bans people under age 18 from having social media accounts, did not pass. A bill prohibiting school districts from disciplining a person for using the legal name or pronouns of a student or staff member, did not pass. A bill expanding the disabled veterans tax credit did not pass. Successes of the session. I would have to say that the biggest successes actually were bookends to this session. The first being House File 68, which is the Students First Act. That was the ESA program that was developed by the governor and working with her. That, to me, was a huge success. On the back end is House File 718, which was the property tax reform bill, so that goes to the whole state. What we heard on the campaign trail and some property tax reforms and relief. That was what I would consider the most notable successes to this year. Disappointments from the session. I would say that House File 2, which became Senate File 507, which affords environmental, social, and governance investing protections for Iowans and small businesses. So the House File 2 was actually a bill that I put together. It basically had three different protections. It protected the pension program, IPERS. It also protected state contracts, and then it protected small businesses. What ended up being Senate File 507, only the first two protections were put in, leaving small businesses out. I wish that would have gotten passed, even just two pieces. I would like to have more protections for small businesses, as we saw small businesses suffer this year through ESG policies by banks. It is a live round for next year, so I look forward to them taking that up and then us doing and providing more protections for small businesses here in Iowa. Charlie Thompson is a Republican who resides in Charles City and represents House District 58. He is a retired Marine and federal government executive and is in his first term in the Iowa House. Key votes, education savings accounts, yes. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, yes. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics, school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bill sponsored, require school administrators to teach classes, did not pass. A bill prohibiting government or citizens of China from buying property in the state did not pass. A bill requiring members of a committee to wear that a ballot was cast in secret when voting in elections did not pass. Dennis Guth. Dennis Guth is a Republican who resides in Clemmy and represents Senate District 28. He is a farmer and in his third term in the Iowa Senate. Key votes, education savings accounts, yes. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, yes. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics, school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bill sponsored, one that requires that medical examiner investigations for infants to three-year-olds include vaccination information, did not pass. A bill allowing schools to offer an elective social studies course focusing on the Bible, did not pass. A bill prohibiting employers from asking about COVID-19 vaccination status, infection status, or requiring a COVID-19 test did not pass. Successes of the session. The biggest success of the session had to be educational savings accounts. It was a big deal for the governor, and I think it's an important thing for the whole state as we work to make parents more in charge of their students' education. One thing that was personally for me was a bill that I wrote, and that is a bill that would require IPERS to divest its investments in Chinese military or government companies. That's something that's becoming more and more popular now. It took me 2 years to get that done. Disappointments from the session. The biggest thing has to be that the Senate did not act on anything dealing with eminent domain and the carbon pipelines. That was a big issue for me and something that I'm very much opposed to. I think it's a constitutional issue. It's not that I don't think it would benefit ethanol and all that, but I think it's unconstitutional and I also think it's a waste of taxpayer money. Sandy Salmon. Sandy Salmon is a Republican who resides in Janesville and represents Senate District 29. She is in her first term in the Senate after five terms in the House. Salmon is the vice chair of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Key votes, education savings accounts, yes. Property tax reductions, yes. Gender-affirming health care ban for minors, yes. Restrictions on LGBTQ topics and school library books, yes. Loosening child labor laws, yes. Bill sponsored, a bill strengthening a ban on divisive concepts during racism or sexism trainings at Iowa schools and creates civil penalties, did not pass. A bill requiring schools to receive parents' permission before administering certain surveys to students, did not pass. A bill prohibiting gender transition medical care for minors did not pass, but similar to Senate File 538. Successes of the session, I would say the property tax reform bill, the school choice bill, and the parental rights and education bill. The property tax reform bill is very much needed, long time coming, and the first step in a multi-year process of property tax reform. The school choice bill provides another great option for parents to find the educational setting that best suits their child, and no one is restricted due to income. The parental rights in education recognizes parents' rights as paramount in a number of school issues dealing with student information and gender identity, and protects children from exposure to sexually explicit materials and LGBT ideology on the taxpayer dime. Disappointments from this session? I would say the unconscionable refusal by the legislature, in particular the Senate, to act to protect the private property rights of farmers and landowners from the potential abuse of eminent domain power by private companies seeking to install hazardous liquid CO2 pipelines on their property. Driven by federal government monetary incentives based on highly debatable climate change science and entangling our ethanol industry, this project threatens to disrupt carefully patterned tiling systems on farmland and damage fragile topsoil needed for optimal crop growth. Erosion of private property rights hurts agriculture in Iowa, and if not stopped, will hurt everyone. Also on the front page, an article entitled Turning Leaf Partners with Mason City Schools to Provide Student Mental Health Care. The Mason City School Board approved the renewal of a contract with a local counseling and mental health services provider to provide daily on-site services at Mason City Schools for the 2023-24 school year. According to the contract, Turning Leaf Consulting Counseling, Inc., a Mason City-based clinic with more than a dozen licensed mental health care providers, will provide assessment, counseling, or therapy services to students on-site. In addition to Mason City, Turning Leaf has similar agreements in place at Forest City, Osage, North Iowa, and West Fork school districts. These services are designed to benefit by not having the student miss as much school to receive professional counseling services and to help families not having to take time off of work to take their child for counseling services. According to Superintendent Pat Hamilton, the agreement is essentially providing space for Turning Leaf to come in and use our facility. It's convenient for parents, students, and for the counselors. Like physical health, positive mental health promotes success in life. Not only our data, but societal data shows that there are people who need help, said Board Member Kathleen Kohler. Just like if you had strep throat, you'd treat it. Public schools have seen an increase in mental health concerns among their students since 2019. Data from the U.S. Department of Education shows that 70% of public schools reported an increase in the percentage of their students seeking mental health services at school, and 76% reported an increase in staff voicing concerns about their students exhibiting symptoms of depression, anxiety, and trauma. Chris Seeger, clinical director with Turning Leaf, says the mental health crisis is because of lack of services. Rural areas like North Iowa are identified as having a shortage of mental health providers, according to the National Health Service Corps. That problem, according to Hamilton, means we could always use more help. HIPAA regulations prevent the school district from releasing any data relating to students' medical conditions or counseling they receive. But the administration says there is a waiting list some days for students to see the school counselors. Seeger says having more counselors at the school eases the burden. Mason City School District employs 11 professional school counselors and 2 social workers, but they are not licensed mental health providers. In other board news, updates to the 9 through 12 math curriculum were made to facilitate better hybrid learning in response to negative student feedback, and the 2023 graduating class was approved with 233 graduates. Mason City High School graduation ceremonies will be held from 2 to 3 p.m. on Sunday, May 21, at the Mason City All-Purpose Arena. And finally, on the front page, an article entitled Barbecue Fundraiser for Kirk Victims. The Retired Firefighters Event Thursday to benefit those who lost homes to the blaze. Retired firefighter Tony Kraft has seen both sides of fire tragedies. As a firefighter, he fought to preserve homes and businesses, but in 1999, he left for work and before he knew it, was left with only the clothes on his back. Now he has plans to give back to everyone involved in the Kirk apartment catastrophe. From 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Thursday, Kraft and his crew from We Three Pig Barbecue will be slinging pulled pork sandwiches, chips, and water for just $5 in the Salvation Army parking lot in Mason City. Kraft is welcoming firefighters, police officers, and generous community members to stop by for the cookout and some appreciation. I've been in both situations. The firefighters put so much into it, and for the victims, well, Kraft doesn't talk a lot about the electrical fire that destroyed his hayfield home and possessions. He doesn't elaborate on the loss or the rebuilding, but emotion is written all over his face. We just want to say thanks and maybe make a little money to help out. If we serve 400 meals, that's about $2,000, and every bit counts, he said. The Kirk apartments burned down April 24. The emergency call came in early that afternoon, and by early evening, the fire raged so fiercely downtown was blackened with smoke. Residents huddled in the parking lot and watched helplessly as the fire destroyed their dwellings. On scene, Tracy Hedegaard Stump, Director of Social Services at the Salvation Army, met with shell-shocked tenants to arrange shelter, food, and other immediate necessities. With 44 units affected, Salvation Army assisted victims to find temporary housing with friends and family. For 7 residents, there was no one to bunk with, even for a short time. Funds that Hedegaard Stump says would normally help with North Iowans to make security deposits or perhaps pay a month of rent were depleted in the aftermath of the calamity. So, to replenish those dollars, We Three Pig Barbecue has donated time, food, and talent. It's just about giving back, Kraft says. It's actually our first time out on our own. I used to work with another guy. I actually got his smoker from him, and now we're ready to give it a shot. In local and state news is an article entitled Mason City Man Pleads Guilty to Arson Drug Charges. A Mason City man pleaded guilty to multiple arson charges and possession of methamphetamine on Tuesday. According to court records, 38-year-old Zachary Bruce Sankey pleaded guilty to 4 counts of second-degree arson and 1 count of possession of methamphetamine. The plea agreement calls for Sankey to be sentenced to 25 years in prison. A statement from Mason City Police Chief Jeff Brinkley said the Mason City Fire and Police Departments responded to numerous fire calls between 5:22 a.m. and 7:15 a.m. on February 28. The plea deal calls for the dismissal of 1 count of second-degree burglary as well. The court is under no obligation to follow the sentencing recommendations. Sankey was allegedly caught with methamphetamine March 7th after posting bail the previous day. In other state news, A nursing home resident tried to suffocate roommate with a pillow. An Eastern Iowa nursing home is facing potential sanctions after a resident of the home tried to suffocate her roommate with a pillow, according to state inspectors. The Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals has cited Winslow House Care Center in Marion for failure to keep residents safe and failure to prevent resident abuse. Resident number two attempted to suffocate resident number one with a blanket and pillow while she lay in bed sleeping, state inspectors wrote in their report about the April incident. A serious adverse outcome was likely to occur if the staff had not intervened and stopped resident number two from applying pressure with the pillow over resident number one's face. According to the inspector's report, an aide was working near the dining room of the facility shortly before noon on April 10 when she heard a woman inside one of the resident rooms attempting to call out in a muffled voice through a pillow and blanket. The aide entered the room and found a female resident standing over her roommate who was lying in bed while pushing a pillow and blanket down onto her face. When workers approached the bed to separate the two, the aggressor was combative, argumentative, and kept yelling she hadn't done anything wrong, the inspectors reported. A review of the care facility's records indicated the resident who had attacked her roommate had dementia and that there had been a series of altercations in the months leading up to the April 10 incident. The previous October, the resident had entered another woman's room, argued with her, and then pushed the woman. Days later, the resident walked to the doorway of another female resident and then hit the woman on both sides of her face. In January, it was reported that the resident had shoved someone in the dining room. One resident at Winslow House told inspectors she was afraid of the woman, but the staff told everyone there was nothing that could be done. The director of nursing allegedly told inspectors that at no time before the last incident did the facility provide any increased supervision of the combative resident. The director of nursing allegedly reported that after the most recent incident, the home did provide one-on-one supervision of the woman for 24 hours, but corporate instructed us we did not need to continue with it. State and federal records indicate the home is owned by the Capstone Group, Inc. The corporation's officers and directors are Michael Michaud and John Whitaker of Marietta, Georgia, and Gregory Slusser of Cedar Rapids. The home is managed by Healthcare of Iowa, Inc., whose president is Dave Chensvold of Cedar Rapids. DIA has imposed, but suspended, two state fines of $6,500 against Winslow House. The suspension of the state fines enables the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to determine whether federal fines are warranted. In the past 3 years, CMS has fined the home a total of $17,933, with the most recent fine imposed in November of 2021. In another article is entitled Study, Baltimore children moved from high poverty to low poverty areas saw their asthma improve. Children with asthma whose families participated in a Baltimore program that helped move them from high poverty neighborhoods to low poverty ones saw their disease get significantly better, according to a study published on Tuesday. The children experienced fewer asthma attacks after moving and struggled with symptoms on fewer days, improvements on par with medication used to treat the chronic condition, said Dr. Craig Pollock, a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Hopkins School of Nursing, and one of the study's lead authors. Between 2016 and 2020, Pollock and a team of about a dozen researchers followed a group of children whose families were working with the Baltimore Regional Housing Partnership, a housing program established as a result of a legal settlement that seeks to combat housing segregation by providing housing vouchers and support to help families move to better resourced neighborhoods. Before moving, according to the study, families lived in neighborhoods where the median household income was $32,542. After moving, the median household income of their new neighborhoods was $83,333. The researchers followed each of the 123 children participating in the study for a year after their family's move. Before the children moved, about 15% had at least one asthma attack every 3 months. After moving, that percentage decreased to around 8.5%. The number of days children experienced asthma symptoms also decreased from 5 days in 2 weeks to 2.7 days, according to the study. After moving, families were more likely to report in surveys that they felt safer in their neighborhoods and felt a greater sense of bonding and belonging among their neighbors, a measure called social cohesion in the study. Researchers estimated that reductions in neighborhood-related stressors explain between 29% and 35% of improvements in the children's asthma. That finding surprised Pollock and his colleagues, since they expected the biggest driver in improvements in a child's symptoms would be decreases in allergens, such as mice and cockroaches. Since a child's asthma often gets better as they grow up, the researchers compared the trajectory of the participating children's asthma to that of 115 children enrolled in another study, which follows children who live in high-poverty neighborhoods in Baltimore, New York, St. Louis, and Boston. Even then, the researchers' findings remained statistically significant. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for May 17, 2023, on IRIS, the Iowa Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. The only obituary in the paper today is Mary Beth Giles, 83, of Torrance, California, passed away on December 11 after a year of deteriorating health, surrounded by her siblings. Aunt Mary was a happy and generous woman, remembered by her nieces and nephews and their own kids for her reliable, though usually tardy, birthday cards, her thoughtful Christmas gifts, and her smile. At a funeral mass held on March 25 at her home of 55 years, in the shadow of her capricious avocado tree, her family and friends celebrated her life. After the service, they shared stories of her kindness and generosity. For decades, Mary was always ready to give an out-of-town visitor a driving tour of Greater LA in her Ford, a T-Bird, Taurus, or Mustang, depending on the era. Her 30-plus years as a companion to her mother, Lois, after her father died in 1965, made her a second grandmother to her nieces and nephews, who learned of the pennies and symptoms and foxes through her genealogical research and tireless cemetery traipsing throughout Iowa and Wisconsin. Mary was born in Riceville, Iowa, on April 6, 1939, to Lois and John Giles, or Jills, the second of four children. After moving to central Wisconsin in 1946, they moved to Garrison, North Dakota in 1948, where she spent her formative years. In 1956, the family moved to Southern California to treat her father's acute allergy problems, a difficult move for a popular 17-year-old high schooler. Senior year at Torrance High, with a student body larger than the entire population of Garrison, was an emotional time that stuck with her for the rest of her life. She excelled in math and other student subjects for a year at El Camino College before leaving to enter the workforce. She embraced Southern California life, working for a time at UCLA during the Wooten years, attending Dodgers games, including the World Series, and embracing the fervor of the 1984 Olympics. Her career highlight was her long tenure working at DPE, where she was a fixture. In retirement, she traveled to countless family weddings and graduations, went deep into genealogy research, solved large jigsaw puzzles, and kept up with the goings-on of her extended family. Her collection of souvenir spoons expanded exponentially as her extended family traveled the country and world and thought of her in souvenir shops. While passing through LAX or Southern California, family and friends found lodging, food, and scotch or margaritas with her and her adopted niece, Yala Dix, who lived with her for a time and who FaceTimed with her daily through the isolation of COVID. Mary was preceded in death by her parents, John and Lois Giles, her older brother, Gordon Giles, and her niece, Joan Gust. She is survived by her sister-in-law, Doris Giles of Minot, North Dakota, her sister, Teresa Mahon of San Diego, her brother, Bill Giles of Gastonbury, Connecticut, 9 nieces and nephews, and many more grandnieces and grandnephews. We have death notices for Sally Irene Anderson, 72, of Mason City, who died May 14, 2023. For Dr. Alan M. Randy Julius, 31, of Davenport, formerly of Mason City, who died May 14, 2023. And for Gloria Wyman, 80, of Clarion, who died Wednesday, May 10, 2023, at the Clarion Wellness and Rehabilitation Center in Clarion. And now in other national news, an article entitled 77 Tons Less Trash Made It Into the Ocean Thanks to This Experimental LA County Device. After a historic winter hit California with dozens of atmospheric rivers, the last line of defense protecting the Pacific from much of LA's trash held strong. In the first storm season of a 2-year pilot project, Bologna Creek Trash Interceptor 007 stopped nearly 155,000 pounds of garbage from flowing out to the ocean. Its performance has exceeded our wildest expectations, said Boyan Slat, founder and chief executive of the Ocean Cleanup. The Dutch nonprofit partnered with the Los Angeles County Department of Public Works to introduce the interceptor in October. The system floats a few hundred yards from the outlet of Bologna Creek into the Pacific Ocean. Its twin booms extended to the shoreline to funnel trash to a solar-powered system that lifts objects from the water with a conveyor belt and drops them into 6 dumpsters. The trash collects in the dumpsters and awaits manual removal. On a recent morning, members of the Public Works Agency were escorted by a local yacht club to witness what could be the final trash offloading of the season. The California Yacht Club, which chartered the brief expedition, has partnered with the Interceptor Project to allow students to see the device in action using club vessels. Its logo will be added to the device alongside that of Coca-Cola and other sponsors in the coming weeks. Ocean Cleanup is not being compensated for the project. The Department of Public Works has staffed the trash interceptor at taxpayers' expense by way of the County Flood Fund with support from contractor Ocean Blue. Hours after the last major rain of the season, a small motorboat chartered by Ocean Blue approached the interceptor and was attached by crews to the internal barge holding the dumpsters. The boat then towed the barge to the Marina Del Rey launch ramp, where additional crews with Ocean Blue were waiting with a crane, a scale, and a truck. The crane slowly lifted a net from each dumpster. The operator shouted out the weight of the debris maintained therein and deposited the contents in a shipping container that would be trucked off for sorting. 3,600, the operator yelled as one particularly full net hung from the crane to approving nods from several crew members. About a dozen workers participated in the offloading from start to finish, and the haul was 19,880 pounds of trash, according to Department of Public Works spokesman Kerjon Lee. paper bags and soda bottles likely washed into the marina from nearby areas in the previous night's rain, bobbed around on the water surface in the basin, a reminder of the pervasive problem of ocean pollution. In all, the first rainy season of the Interceptor's operation saw the collection of 77 tons of material, of which nearly two-thirds was inorganic. The first pilot year had all the challenges we wanted it to have. Heavy pollutants, lots of flow, said Mark Pestrella, the Department of Public Works director. In January, storm-generated waves caused one boom to tear, and it had to be replaced. According to Lee, L.A. County Department of Beaches and Harbors maintenance crews noted a 75% reduction in trash along local beaches adjacent to the Interceptor. Though the department has yet to issue its first-year report, which will include the cost of the program, Pestrella said that capturing trash early was way, way cheaper than county crews collecting it from beaches. The device, which will be donated to the county if officials deem its two-year pilot a success, may end up saving taxpayers some money, even when taking into account the cost of staffing it. Even with the success of Interceptor 007, which Pestrella said was the only one of its kind in the U.S., major problems with pollution in L.A. County waterways persist. None of the waterways in L.A. County are considered fishable or swimmable due to pollution, he said, and tests show toxicity in every drainage for some pollutant of concern. He pointed to industrial and corporate polluters, who he said leave cleanup duties to citizens and government. I don't see enough corporate participation in cleanup efforts, he said. The burden cannot be all put on the taxpayer, the residential property owner, or for that matter, the renter, Pestrella said. They're making a ton of money off that trash on the front end, he said, alluding to products, packaging, and advertising materials that can end up in waterways. And we're picking it up at another cost to the consumer. Angelinos produce 4 to 5 pounds of trash per person per day, he said. And too often, the trash is disposed of improperly. The ocean and these rivers, Pestrella said, should not be the trash can of our community. In other national news, an article entitled Biden Rethinks Overseas Trip. President Joe Biden and top congressional leaders opened their second meeting on Tuesday in talks over raising the nation's debt limit, as the White House said it will reevaluate parts of Biden's overseas trip that is scheduled to begin this week. Biden met with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Unlike last week's meeting, Vice President Kamala Harris participated in Tuesday's session. We're just getting started, Biden said in brief remarks to reporters ahead of the meeting in the Oval Office. Biden has remained optimistic on the talks, while McCarthy has said publicly that the negotiations have made little progress ahead of a June 1 deadline, which is when the Treasury Department says the U.S. could begin defaulting on its debt. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the administration was evaluating whether it makes sense for the president to continue with the rest of his foreign trip after attending a Group of Seven summit in Japan. Biden was scheduled to leave Wednesday for the summit, followed by stops in Papua New Guinea and Australia. Kirby blamed congressional Republicans. We wouldn't even be having this discussion about the effect of the debt ceiling debate on the trip if Congress would do its job, raise the debt ceiling the way they've always done, Kirby said. How much is too much, McCarthy said Tuesday about the nation's $31 trillion debt load as he pushed for stricter work requirements on governmental aid recipients as a way to cut spending. Democrats are concerned about the idea of putting new work requirements for government aid recipients on the table after Biden suggested he could be open to such changes. In state news, an article entitled Governor Reynolds Signs Fentanyl Overdose Penalty Hikes into Law Iowa elected officials took action at the state and federal level aimed at combating rising rates of fentanyl-related drug overdoses on Tuesday. Surrounded by state and local law enforcement, Reynolds signed the law in Atlantic, Iowa, where last year five area residents were arrested on federal charges in a fentanyl distribution case that led to a series of overdoses in Cass and Shelby counties. The law enhances the penalty for selling fentanyl, imposing up to 10 years of prison time for small amounts of the potent opioid and up to 50 years for more than 50 grams. The law will also triple the sentence otherwise imposed by law for providing a drug that results in someone's death and double the sentence if it results in bodily injury. Manufacturing a drug in the presence of a minor or selling to a minor would carry twice the penalty otherwise imposed by law. This poison, and that's what it is, poison, is fueling addiction, death, and chaos, Reynolds, a Republican, said. The law proposed by Reynolds early in this year's legislative session is part of her push to put a spotlight on the rising presence of fentanyl in Iowa and its role in overdose deaths. Fentanyl, a potent opioid about 100 times stronger than morphine, is often mixed into illicit pills, pressed to look like other prescription medications and other drugs as a cost-cutting measure. Reynolds said Iowa law enforcement seized twice the number of fentanyl pills in 2022 than it did in 2021, and more than 27,000 in the last 6 weeks. Synthetic opioids, like fentanyl, accounted for more than 80% of all opioid-related overdoses nationally in 2020, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Iowa's rate of overdose deaths is among the lowest in the country, but it is increasing. In Iowa, 432 people died of drug overdoses in 2020, according to the CDC, and 172 of those, about 40%, were from synthetic opioids. A similar bill was proposed by Republican Attorney General Brenna Byrd at the beginning of this year's legislative session. Byrd said the law will allow prosecutors to seek stricter penalties at the state level when a person dies from a drug overdose. This law brings the drug dealers who kill to justice, she said. It gives prosecutors the tool that we need to seek justice for the victims of crime and their families, and it prevents the scourge of the dangers of drugs in our communities. Under the new law, fentanyl sale and manufacture will be punished with the following ways. Less than 5 grams, Class C felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a fine between $1,000 and $50,000. Between 5 and 50 grams, a Class B felony, punishable by up to 25 years in prison and a fine of up to $100,000. More than 50 grams, a Class B felony, punishable by up to 50 years in prison and a fine of up to $1 million. The bill also expands who can dispense naloxone, a medication that reverses the effects of an overdose. The changes will allow law enforcement, emergency rooms, and schools to get it into the hands of those who need it most, Reynolds said. The law passed with mostly bipartisan support in the legislature this year. But some Democrats opposed the law. They argued increasing penalties does not work in reducing criminal activity, and the bill did not do enough to prioritize treatment of substance abuse disorders. Democrat Representative Megan Srinivas, a doctor from Des Moines, proposed an amendment to the bill that would have legalized fentanyl test strips, which can be used to test for the presence of fentanyl in a pill or other drug. Reynolds says she does not think fentanyl test strips should be part of the solution to the rising opioid deaths. That's not something that I pushed in my bill, because I don't think that that has an appropriate place, she said. Reynolds also took aim at Democratic President Joe Biden's administration, whose border policies, she said, are to blame for the increase in fentanyl coming across the southern border. President Biden has a constitutional responsibility to secure our nation's border from illegal immigration and drug trafficking, human trafficking, and everything that's taking place at the southern border, she said. His failure is empowering criminals. It's empowering the cartel who trade others' lives for profit. Ernst unveils a bill aimed at fentanyl trafficking. Around the same time Reynolds signed the new law, Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst announced plans to introduce a bipartisan, bicameral bill with Virginia Democratic U.S. Senator Tim Kaine that would direct the Department of Defense to take stronger action against Mexican cartels and transnational criminal organizations trafficking fentanyl. Both Ernst and Kaine serve on the Senate Armed Services Committee. I'm using my oversight authority of the Department of Defense to stem fentanyl crisis at its source, Ernst told reporters. The Disrupt Fentanyl Trafficking Act would classify fentanyl trafficking as a national security threat to provide a response proportional to the problem, Ernst said during a conference call with reporters. It would require the Pentagon to develop a fentanyl-specific counter-drug strategy, including working directly with the Mexican military and increasing security operations with Mexico to combat the fentanyl drug trade and disrupt Mexican cartel activity. The bill also seeks to address and better coordinate efforts between the military and federal law enforcement agencies. The Department of Defense plays a leading role in the nation's counter-drug intelligence and monitoring operations, Ernst said. However, the lack of intra-agency cooperation, overclassification, and inadequate resources have hampered our government's counter-fentanyl efforts. Fentanyl has become a leading cause of death in U.S. adults between the ages of 18 and 45. President Joe Biden, in his State of the Union address earlier this year, vowed to do more to tackle the epidemic. The amount of lives lost in Iowa and across the country due to this deadly drug has far surpassed the federal government's response, and we must scale immediately to combat this national security threat, Ernst said in a statement following her news conference. This bipartisan work will engage Mexico as an active partner to counter fentanyl trafficking and put the Pentagon's tools to use to save American lives. Ernst met with Mexican officials at the Mexican embassy during a visit to Mexico City and the San Diego-Mexican border back in February as part of a congressional delegation that included Iowa Republican U.S. Representatives Randy Feenstra and Marionette Miller Meeks. She said the crisis will only get worse with the expiration of a COVID-era policy that allowed, known as Title 42, that allowed U.S. authorities to quickly expel migrants on public health grounds. Republican lawmakers have lambasted President Joe Biden and his administration's handling of a historic influx of illegal border crossings they say has allowed fentanyl to be smuggled into the U.S. at higher rates and fueled the opioid crisis. Biden initially kept the Title 42 in place after he took office, then tried to end its use in 2022. Republicans sued, arguing the restrictions were necessary for border security. Courts had kept the rules in place, but with the end of national COVID-19 emergencies, the border restrictions have now gone away. The federal government, however, is putting new restrictions into place at its southern border to try to stop migrants from crossing illegally and encourage them instead to apply for asylum online through a new process. The White House earlier this month announced the Pentagon is sending 1,500 troops to support U.S. Customs and Border Patrol and counter-smuggling operation in the Darien Gap, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is expanding detention capacity and deploying more resources and technology to support border communities, including hundreds more asylum officers and immigration judges to process migrants, according to the White House. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for May 17, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.